but found it hard to balance her personal life and her job. Still wanting to advocate for domestic violence victims, she took a different approach.
I took some time off and started a business called Kase Indigenous Foodways. And my hope and goal is to help people reconnect back to the land and to each other. I'm passionate about helping people, and including myself, with healing, and our families and our communities.
Michelson's approach on using food for healing goes hand in hand with this year's Alaska Federation of Natives Convention theme, Our Ways of Life, by exploring the subsistence lifestyles and communities in the state and how using culture and traditions can help address today's challenges. I'm Jill Freitas.
You are listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 19th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegadoff, Roz Brown, and Alex Gonzalez. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for listening. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now's a great time to join. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. And stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
It's cold in here. I need a sweater, but one that expresses my values. I know, my limited KBOO Sound of Democracy crew neck. And you can find it at kboo.fm/sod shirt on the sidebar of the homepage. But there's so many colors. How will I pick? Gray? Red? I know. What about oregano?
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. Notes on the war in Israel. Aboriginal groups lose the referendum in Australia. And who will be the Dalai Lama's successor? Notes on the war. David Grossman is an award-winning Israeli writer. In the Financial Times of London recently, he wrote very critically of Benjamin Netanyahu's corrupt leadership and the murderous attacks by Hamas. Two great tragedies that will affect and infect Israel for many years to come. Already, polls show that the great majority of Israelis want Netanyahu's resignation once the war is over. But by then, the destruction, not just of Hamas, but of Gaza, will be all but complete. Grossman asks, quote, "Who will we be, and what kind of human beings will we be after seeing what we've seen? Where will we start after the destruction and loss of so many things we believed in and trusted? If I may hazard a guess, Israel after the war will be much more right-wing, militant, and racist. The war forced on us will have cemented the most extreme, hateful stereotypes and prejudices that frame and will continue to frame all the more robustly Israeli identity. And that identity will from now on also embody the trauma of October 2023, as well as the polarization, the internal rift," unquote. U.S. State Department officers are being censored when it comes to discussing the war. They have been discouraged from using three phrases that suggest criticism of Israel's use of force: de-escalation ceasefire, end to violence bloodshed, and restoring calm. Behind that censorship is the view of top U.S. officials who are being very careful about urging restraint on Israel's military. All of them, from the president on down, face a dilemma: how to support Israel 100%, yet influence Israel's strategy in Gaza. President Biden quietly warned Israel not to occupy Gaza. Now he's in Israel, presumably to reinforce the message of support and restraint. But giving full support undermines the call for restraint. It's more like a green light for Netanyahu's plans to lay siege to Gaza. 600,000 Palestinians in Gaza have left their homes, desperately trying to reach safety, yet facing a closed border with Egypt. Gazans have been without water since October 7. Hospitals are without electricity. Fuel and food imports have been forced to stop. Can Biden's visit change that situation? A still larger crisis looms, the threat of a region-wide war. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan acknowledged as much when announcing deployments of U.S. air and naval power to the region to deter Hezbollah and Iran. Deterrence, however, looks like intervention from another angle. If Iran were to challenge U.S. ships, for instance, or if Hezbollah's soldiers were to engage Israel in a major firefight, U.S. forces might be drawn into a battle that would open a new front in the war. The latest deployment of a U.S. Marine Rapid Response Force reinforces that kind of speculation. One final note: Israeli and U.S. hopes for a normalization agreement with Saudi Arabia have been set back. The Saudis have announced a pause in normalization talks, citing the Israeli bombardment of Gaza. The disruption of talks is a victory for Hamas, which, according to some specialists, had that aim in attacking Israel. Aboriginal groups lose a referendum in Australia. Australia held a referendum to decide on constitutional recognition of Indigenous people, First Nations as they're called, and a voice in Parliament. The referendum lost despite support from the Prime Minister and much to the shock of Indigenous people. As one wrote, the debate preceding the vote was, quote, "vitriolic, mean-spirited, full of misinformation, driven by racism, petty grievances, and conspiracy theories based on fear and ignorance." The referendum became by proxy a vote on Indigenous people's right to exist in our own land, and our fellow Australians voted to reject it, unquote. Another First Nation writer said, quote, "the referendum did not divide this country, it exposed it, and that exposed racism and ignorance must be addressed urgently and in a bipartisan manner by political leaders at all levels. Surely they can agree on that, if nothing else," unquote. First Nations advocates vow to continue their campaign for recognition, but they are pessimistic. Wrote one, quote, "Prime Minister Anthony Albanese was fond of saying during the campaign, if not now, then when? On Saturday night, he got an answer: never. There won't be another referendum anytime soon to recognize Indigenous people in the nation's birth certificate. And it was voted down by the people who were never given an honest alternative plan. No ideas, no vision, no explanation of how the status quo is going to materially improve Aboriginal lives," unquote. Who will be the Dalai Lama's successor? China may soon name a successor to the Dalai Lama, Tibetan Buddhism's highest order. It would be an outrageous act, equivalent to China's takeover in 1995 of the succession of the Panchen Lama, the second highest order. Then, Beijing kidnapped the boy who was to be the rightful successor, replacing him with a monk. Such audacious interference in Tibetan Buddhist affairs is deeply offensive and is bound to cause an eruption. Beijing has no basis other than being an occupying power for naming a successor. As the Dalai Lama says, quote, no recognition or acceptance should be given to a candidate chosen for political ends by anyone, including those in the People's Republic of China, unquote. One Tibetan authority adds, Tibetan's connection to the Dalai Lama dates to the 15th century. The successive Dalai Lamas have been the core of Tibetan politics and religion for nearly 400 years. Only the Dalai Lama himself can name a reincarnate from among Buddhist lamas, contrary to Beijing's decree in 2007 that the Chinese Communist Party alone may name a successor. The Chinese Panchen, as the man who was appointed in 1995 is called by most Tibetans, is a sad case, similar to what an occupying power does when it installs a puppet regime. That man lives in Beijing and rarely visits Tibet. Should China designate a new Dalai Lama, he will suffer from the same illegitimacy. It's a cruel farce, worthy of international protest, since it affects China's relations with India, where the Dalai Lama has lived since 1959, and with Mongolia, which has a large Buddhist population that idolizes the Dalai Lama and is home to the third highest sect of Tibetan Buddhism. In other news, Chinese police overreach in Fiji. It's an increasingly common story in the Pacific Island states. The Chinese government concludes a seemingly innocuous memorandum of understanding on security cooperation, and before you know it, Chinese police have arrived and started behaving as though they are on Chinese territory. This is what happened in Fiji, where Chinese police rounded up 77 Chinese nationals and flew them back to the mainland for prosecution of an internet scheme, all done without any documentation or local approval. Ordinarily, security cooperation agreements with China have involved police training and China's provision of surveillance equipment, but those supposed benefits are often just the beginning of deeper penetration of island affairs, as has happened in the Solomon Islands, where Taiwanese influence has been curtailed and a secret understanding on a Chinese base remains to be explained. China's police operations, let's keep in mind, are also taking place in the United Kingdom and right here. Chinese security personnel, with help from loyal students, keep an eye on Chinese residents abroad who act in ways considered disloyal to the country and its Communist Party. If these minders report people, the Public Security Bureau back home pressures their families to rein in their relatives abroad or face interrogation and arrest. The China-Taiwan battle for diplomatic recognition continues. In recent years, Taiwan's international standing as the Republic of China has gradually eroded. Today, only 13 countries recognize Taiwan as China. The latest country to shift recognition from Taiwan to the People's Republic of China is Honduras, whose president received a grand reception in Beijing and most likely a pile of money. That's because Honduras is deeply in debt, including around $600 million owed to Taiwan. When Honduras reportedly demanded aid from Taiwan of $1.2 billion, Taiwan refused, leaving Beijing with an opening. Taiwan has long had a very effective foreign aid program, which accounts in large part for it still being recognized by 13 countries. Most of them are small countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, such as Paraguay, Belize, Haiti, St. Kitts and Nevis, and so on. The significance of losing Honduras is that it shows how hard it is for Taiwan to compete with Chinese money. But it also shows that China can outcompete the U.S. in America's backyard. The U.S. has a small military presence in Honduras, devoted mainly to counter-narcotics efforts. Biden pressured Honduras to stick with Taiwan, to no avail. Guatemala is said to be next to defect to China, probably for the same reasons expressed by Honduran leaders. More trade, access to technology, increased investment. International students are again coming to the U.S. After a lengthy pause caused by COVID and tensions in U.S.-China relations, international students are again coming to the U.S. in large numbers. Over 300,000 students received visas to study in the U.S. in the current academic year. India now claims the top spot in total students here, surpassing China for the first time in 15 years. Indian students in the U.S. number about 320,000, compared with 254,000 Chinese students. Those Indian students also stay in the U.S. much longer than Chinese students, mainly for job experience. The danger of war in the South China Sea increases. The Philippines is fighting back against Chinese efforts to limit its access to waters claimed by Manila. That has both positive and negative implications. After enduring months of pressure from heavily armed Chinese Coast Guard vessels, the Philippines retaliated. Divers removed a floating barrier designed to keep Philippines fishing and Coast Guard vessels from going about their business. This prompted a warning from the Chinese side on the basis that the Philippines was engaged in unapproved entry in violation of China's sovereignty. The Chinese boats keep increasing in number as they attempt to block Philippine access to its claimed waters. At some point, an exchange of gunfire seems likely, especially since U.S. ships are conducting joint exercises with the Philippines and U.S. aircraft are reporting near misses with Chinese jets. The situation is tailor-made for a serious conflict. The end of Nagorno-Karabakh. A few weeks ago, Azerbaijan's attack on the Armenian enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh was being described as a genocide. Now that attack is over and it accomplished its objective, Nagorno-Karabakh is no more. Azerbaijan controls it, and the Nagorno-Karabakh government has dissolved, ending 30 years of fighting. Roughly half the population is in flight now, seeking residence in Armenia or farther away. For now, the Russians and the Turks have their way in their aggression. But there are others, Iran and India, for example, that support the Armenians. The Caucasus may again become a cauldron of international conflict. The U.S. and Ukraine sign joint weapons production deal. The U.S. military aid to Ukraine has everyone's attention these days. One less reported part of the recent visit by Ukraine's President Zelensky to Washington is the signing of a deal for joint production of weapons. Three Ukraine companies have agreed with some 2,000 U.S. companies on developing production lines, with air defense systems one specific item. The goal is not just to improve Ukraine's ability to manufacture its own weapons, but also to strengthen its economy and provide jobs. Finally, a depressing report on global warming. Scientists at Berkeley Earth are reporting a new and very disturbing change in the pattern of global warming. It is not merely increasing gradually, it is accelerating. The rate of warming is 40% higher than the rate in the 1970s. Over the past 3 months, warming registered well above 1.5 degrees centigrade, the usual danger point for warming above pre-industrial levels. That makes 2023 the hottest year on record and means that all the signs of environmental trouble, droughts, hurricanes, etc., will be much worse much sooner. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Mel Gertov. Take good care.
Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to Cable News In Depth. I'm Andrew Black. Oxfam America recently released this year's edition of its Best States to Work report. The report talks about the rapidly growing inequality in the country and shows which states are filling the gaps left by federal inaction in supporting workers and their families. KBOO's David Rosenberg spoke with Caitlin Henderson, a senior research advisor with Oxfam America's U.S. Domestic Policy Program, to learn more.
So the best states and the worst states, were you at all surprised at the results when you looked into this issue?
I wasn't super surprised by a lot of the results. We see a lot of consistency in performance at the top and the bottom of our index, states being really steady with either consistently providing a lot of support for working workers and working families or struggling to provide those policies that we track in the index. But every year there's some really exciting movement happening, usually with states around the middle, of showing real progress in different policy areas. So it's always an exciting project to update year over year.
And how do you define what are the best states to work in? Is it wages? Is it worker protection? What goes into that analysis?
Yeah, our index actually has 26 policies across three big themes, and those themes are wages, worker protections, and rights to organize. So the way we measure states is across all 26 areas. So that does include everything from minimum wages and tipped wages to paid leave and scheduling protections to also the ability for public and private workers to organize and collectively bargain.
It seems like some of the worst states, maybe all of them, are in the South. Any progress there at all?
The South is very consistent in terms of ending up at the bottom of our index, but there has been some important changes that have happened that I do like to highlight. A few years ago, there was a ballot initiative in Florida that passed by a very strong margin, which raised the minimum wage for the state. And as a result of that ballot initiative, which really was the voice of the people, because voters themselves put the initiative on, Florida moved up in our rankings. And another example that we really love to sort of lift up as an example of something that's great is Virginia jumped up our rankings pretty significantly since we started this index in 2018. When we first released the index, Virginia was at the very bottom, and now it's in the top half. And that's the result of a lot of great policies that were passed due to workers organizing and voters really advocating for a change. And policies that passed in Virginia that really impacted its ranking were a higher minimum wage, a domestic workers' bill of rights, the ability for public teachers to collectively bargain in the state. So change is very, very possible, and it's always very exciting to see when it happens.
Can a state move up in the rankings because certain cities pass progressive legislation, or does it have to be something that's done statewide?
It has to be at the state level. This index only looks at the state level and doesn't look locally. So there are certainly cities that even outperform the state where they are in, even if the state performs very well. But we're really only looking at the state level for this index.
How about right-to-work states? Any progress there? It seems, those states are very hard to organize in and make any progress in.
That's absolutely true. So this year, for the first time in decades, a state actually overturned its right-to-work law, which is Michigan. I believe that's the first time a state has overturned its right to work law since the 60s. So this was a huge win, a really huge moment. And that makes such a big difference. So in terms of movement overturning right to work laws, we are starting to see a little bit of a sea change, which is very exciting. But as you suggest, that policy on the books really makes a big difference in repressing organizing for workers and the ability for workers to collectively bargain.
Does the fact that we have a federal system actually hurt workers in a way, because states can really make their own laws and there's going to be an unevenness around the country?
Well, I would say this index provides an opportunity for states to improve the reality for workers and working families, but it really especially calls on the federal government to raise the standard for all workers. The system of governance that we have in this country says that while states can go beyond what is available at the federal level really does set the floor. So we expect and hope that this index can provide something of a map for the federal government to improve itself if there are those states that choose to stay stagnant or rely on federal standards, then this is an opportunity for the federal government to improve that standard.
So one of the factors that helps workers improve their lives is their ability to collectively bargain. As you look at the country, which states make it easiest to do that and which states make it hardest?
So any state that does not have a so-called right-to-work law makes it easier for unions to exist and for workers to collectively bargain. But one of the things we did this year in our report was we took a look at the correlation between states that perform well on our index and states that have high rates of unionization. So unsurprisingly, those states that do not have a right-to-work law have much higher rates of unionization. And one of the great examples, actually, Hawaii has a very high rate of unionization amongst its workers. But really, the union difference is so important. We know that where unions exist, the pay gap is smaller, there are greater protections for workers, and they can ask for more flexibility. It makes a big difference in terms of helping all workers, but especially women and especially workers of color.
In states where there are more rights for unions, does that put upward pressure on non-union employers, or is the union movement just not strong enough to do that?
I think it depends, to be honest, on the sector. I think it depends on the state. Some states are more reliant on some sectors and industries than others. There are states for which agricultural workers are hugely important to their economy, and the challenges for agricultural workers to unionize and collectively bargain are much higher than other sectors as a result of the National Labor Standards Act that created the ability for workers to organize in the 1930s. So I think it really depends on what the state is and what the workers are, but we are seeing a huge change in terms of popular support for unionization and collectively bargaining, which is really exciting, and it makes a very big difference. So I think it's a situation of watching this space.
Any legislation on the national level that needs to be overturned in order to make it easier for workers to organize?
I don't know about overturning. I would say there's some really great bills at the federal level that, if passed, would make a really big difference. And the number one bill that comes to mind is the PRO Act, or the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which this year was named for Richard Trumka. And that is a bill that, if passed, would allow all workers, regardless of the state where they live, to have greater access to the ability to organize and to collectively bargain. So there are great opportunities for change, and those opportunities have already been written and presented to Congress. It's just a matter of congressional representatives taking those opportunities and really passing that legislation.
Did any of your research involve undocumented workers and how they're faring? Did they figure into this at all?
Certainly. So we don't have any policies in this index that specifically speaks towards, or rather targets, undocumented workers. But there are policies in our index that, if they do exist, they certainly benefit undocumented workers. And some of those have to do with farm workers. There are a lot of undocumented workers that work in the agricultural industry. There are some states that have passed provisions for all agricultural workers without specification of their documented status. There are also states that have a domestic worker bill of rights. Not all, but many domestic workers can sometimes be undocumented. And the reality is that where there is this robust policies in support of workers and working families, many of those policies don't have caveats suggesting that they should only apply to documented workers. It is rather an application to employees. So that doesn't have a specification of documented status.
That was Caitlin Henderson of Oxfam American speaking with KBOO's David Rosenberg about the recent edition of the Best States to Work report. I'm Ender Black. Thanks for listening.
listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7.
We invite you to participate in our brand new public affairs program, Once Upon a Time. Share with us your memories and touchstone events of your life. Join us for our premiere, Friday, October 20th, 11 a.m. to noon, here on KBOO 90.7 FM and available online at kboo.fm. Consuelo is my name, and I will be glad to hear from you and reminisce about your journey. Friday, October 20th, 11 a.m. to noon, Once Upon a Time, live in the air room here at KBOO 90.7 FM.
From applicant tracking systems to chatbots to facial recognition, artificial